coming up on Philosophy Talk.
The fish are so happy.
How do you know? You're not a fish.
How do you know I don't know? You're not me.
Is this some kind of Taoist riddle?
Zhuangzi, Chinese philosophy from the 4th century BCE.
One of the founding figures of Taoism.
Did Zhuangzi think that everything was relative?
You might think you're hot stuff, but fish just think you look scary.
What if I'm just a butterfly dreaming that I'm a philosopher?
What if I'm just a philosopher dreaming that I'm a butterfly?
I think the stories are confusing in the way that life is confusing.
Our guest is Paul Chilberg from Whittier College,
editor of Skepticism, Relativism, and Ethics in the Zhuangzi.
By immersing yourself into confusion, you understand better the way in which our experience is confusing.
What does it even mean to be one with 10,000 things?
The Tao of Love. Everybody knows that.
Taoism in the Zhuangzi. Coming up on Philosophy Talk. This Thursday, join us at KALW's community space in downtown San Francisco for Philosophy Talk's first ever quiz night.
There'll be refreshments, prizes, and lots of philosophical fun.
That's this Thursday, November 9th, 6 p.m. at 220 Montgomery Street in San Francisco.
Come question everything.
Except your trivia knowledge.
Could you be a butterfly dreaming you're a person?
Is anything objectively good or bad?
What does Zhuangzi have to tell us about the way to live?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, we're thinking about Zhuangzi.
Zhuangzi, fantastic Taoist philosopher from 4th century BCE China. He's so great.
Yeah, I just love the book of his writings where he argues that everything is relative. He writes, "From the point of view of the way, no thing is more valuable than any other." What a great idea.
That doesn't sound so great to me, Ray. It sounds like it could be a recipe for confusion and apathy, maybe even bad behavior.
Well, who's to say whether a behavior is good or bad? I mean, Zhuangzi doesn't even think that makes sense. He says, "When people sleep in a damp place, they wake up deathly ill. But what about eels? If people live in trees, they tremble with fear and worries. But how about monkeys? Of these three, which knows what is the right place to live?"
I love that quote so much. Maybe it's partly because I'm such a big fan of eels and monkeys. But I still think it kind of suggests the opposite of what you want to be saying. I mean, look, I don't want to sleep in the river like an eel. He's right about that. I don't really feel like sleeping up in a tree like a monkey. But doesn't that precisely mean there is something that's good for a human being? It's good for a human being to sleep in a bed under a roof.
You sound just like those Confucian philosophers from Zhuangzi's time. They also think there's a single good way to be a human being.
Right. They said it's really important to respect your elders, uphold order, do all the proper rituals, be benevolent and responsible, and, you know, perfectly inhabit your social role.
Yeah, and Zhuangzi realized they were totally wrong. He gave this great example of a useless tree. It's really bad at performing its social role. It's so gnarly and twisted that no carpenter can use it for anything. So it survives while all the other trees get cut down and turned into lumber.
But that's exactly my point, Ray. I mean, for a tree, presumably, it's good not to get cut down. And in the same way, for a human being, it's good to have a roof over your head. Some things are good, some things are bad.
Okay, but even if some things are good and some things are bad, you're not going to figure out which is which just by listening to authority. Zhuangzi has this story about a guy who's going for a swim in the middle of a raging waterfall. Somebody asks him how he got so good at swimming. And he says, nobody taught him. He just followed his inborn nature. So that just goes to show. You should listen to your nature. You shouldn't listen to teachers.
Don't listen to teachers? Who's telling me that?
Zhuangzi.
Okay, so let me see if I have you right here. The sage tells me not to listen to sages. The advice is not to listen to advice. There's a practice, but it doesn't involve practice. And it's good for us, except that nothing is good or bad. Did I miss anything?
Oh, Josh, you and your logic. The whole point of Zhuangzi is to get beyond these pointless arguments that don't give us any insight. He says, "What man knows is far less than what he does not know. It is because he tries to exhaust this vastness with his meagerness that he bewilders and frustrates himself.
I mean, that's really nice and everything, but aren't you supposed to be a philosopher? Are you seriously trying to tell me we should give up trying to know things?
Oh, I'm not trying to tell you anything. How could I possibly know?
Nice one, Ray. But seriously, okay, I get that giving up on knowledge would help me to stay calm, but it wouldn't bring me that much joy. I mean, remember what Chuang Tzu says about what he calls the great clump, right? Nature, the universe, or what have you. He says, it burdens me with a physical form, labors me with life, eases me with old age, rests me with death. That doesn't sound like a very cheerful existence.
You're missing the point. If everyone would just calm down and stop striving, the world would be so much better. We wouldn't have wars or greed or oppression. Come on, Josh, wouldn't that be the greatest thing ever?
I thought you said nothing is better than anything else.
Okay, I don't have a great way out of that one, but I bet our guest does. It's Paul Chelberg from Whittier College, editor of a volume of essays on the Chuang Tzu.
But first, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to talk to people who've taken Chuang Tzu's writings to interesting places. She files this report.
Picture a man with a chin stuck down in his navel, shoulders up above his head, pigtail pointing to the sky, five internal organs on display. The man is Splay Lim Shu. His creator is Chuang Tzu, and it may not seem ideal to have five organs, but the man is out there living his best life.
By sewing and washing, he gets enough to fill his mouth. By handling a winnow and sifting out the good grain, he makes enough to feed 10 people.
Both in ancient China and in the world today, we'd tend to describe this person as disabled and as unfortunate because they're not like other people.
That's Brian Van Norden, a professor of philosophy at Vassar College. He co-wrote a New York Times op-ed about how Chuang Tzu pushed back against the idea that normal is good and different is bad. And he did it more than 2,500 years ago.
The reality is that their disabilities in some way open up other opportunities to them.
This is why Chuang Tzu is so radical.
Van Norden's co-author was John Altman, who studies and writes about philosophy and disabilities.
There's so much to Chuang Tzu.
Altman says the way people think about disabilities still needs to catch up with Chuang Tzu. Altman loves how he imbues dignity on these awesome characters.
He gives the parable of the knotted tree, the tree that can't be anything.
But the tree is great.
And because he gives up on his instrumental calculations for the tree, you know, the means ends efficient kind of thinking of the tree is able to live out its years.
So for your big tree, no use? Then plant it in the wasteland, in emptiness. Walk idly around. Rest under its shadow. No axe or bill prepares its end. No one will ever cut it down. Useless. You should worry.
Ancient philosophers have often been cruel to people with disabilities. For example, Aristotle argues that, quote, deformed kids should be left to die. In another Chuang Tzu writing, Confucius meets an amputee named Sushin No Toes. Confucius judges him, but Sushin No Toes knows there are more important things in life than toes.
But I've come now because I still have something that is worth more than a foot, and I want to try to hold on to it. There is nothing that heaven doesn't cover. Nothing that Earth doesn't bear up.
There's so much hostility to what philosophy would call alterity, you know, another way of saying difference. And Chuang Tzu was one of the earliest voices to say it doesn't need to be that way. And I just think there's an immense beauty in that.
A lot of Chuang Tzu's ideas are just really nice, like how he writes about being one with 10,000 things.
You know, a lot of Buddhist thinking and worldview are really about looking at notions of duality and how that exists alongside the notion that we are not separate from the world, that we are one.
That's Xinyi Pai, host of the 10,000 Things podcast, all about modern-day artifacts of Asian American life.
In many Chinese sayings and in classical poetry, the number 10,000 is used in a lyrical sense to convey something infinite, vast, and unfathomable.
There's an episode about a now historical blue suit worn by a Korean-American lawmaker cleaning up after the January 6th insurrection.
I bought the blue suit initially to be something that I wear to President Biden's inauguration. And I wanted to wear it that day on January 6th because that was the day that we were going to certify the election results.
Other episodes are about bikes, a book, and an episode on voices featuring Alice Wong, who lost her physical voice after a catastrophic medical event.
Ideas of what is considered a good voice gatekeep marginalized people, making them feel they can't take up space and sound. And the reality is there is space and sound for all of us.
There are so many expressions and permutations of Asian American identity, 10,000 of them, you know, infinite and vast, right? And this series was really an effort towards narrative change and humanizing stories of the Asian American experience, and maybe also bringing some insight into Asian cultures and identity.
Zhuangzi would appreciate that. He says, do not struggle. Go with the flow of things, and you will find yourself at one with the mysterious unity of the universe. Let's end there. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks so much for that fascinating report, Holly. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And today we're thinking about Zhuangzi.
And we're joined now by Paul Chelberg. He is professor of philosophy at Whittier College and editor of Essays on Skepticism, Relativism, and Ethics in the Zhuangzi. Paul, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Paul, Zhuangzi talks a lot about the importance of doing nothing. And I've got to say, I kind of like the sound of that. Does it resonate with anything in your own life?
I do quite a bit of nothing, and I'm looking forward to retirement and doing even more in the near future.
Okay, so that sounds pretty great. But I want to hear more about Zhuangzi's idea of doing nothing. So what does that actually amount to?
Well, it's difficult to describe. It's certainly not sitting still with your arms crossed. Doing nothing means more like doing nothing on purpose or doing nothing intentional, rather like having a conversation. You don't go into it with a plan. You just respond to the situation as it arises and let things happen. It's not something you do. It's something you let.
Does it make sense to advise people to do nothing? Like, if you advise somebody to do something, don't they have to do it?
They don't have to do it, but there are other ways of encouraging people or leading people than just telling them.
I find this really interesting. It goes along with a couple of things. A couple of quotes I really like in the Zhuangzi, right? So that line about drifting uncommitted in the great work of doing nothing in particular. So you're doing something, but nothing in particular, and lines about not planning your affairs in advance. I wanted to ask you about a particular quote I find really beautiful, which is attributed to someone called Chui the Artisan. The forgetting of the foot means the shoe fits comfortably. The forgetting of the waist means the belt fits comfortably. And when the understanding forgets right and wrong, the mind fits comfortably. Can you explain that to us? Is the thought here supposed to be that you act without a plan, you do nothing in particular, you don't think too much about it, but you somehow end up doing good things?
Look, doing something and doing nothing are not necessarily incompatible. I like doing yard work. There's a lot of thinking to be involved, figuring out how to fall a tree, which best way to split a log, things like that. So there's a lot of rationality and planning. But when my son comes home and asks what I did today, I tell him nothing. I was just hanging around. When you go on a trip, you make plans and procedures, but you're not really doing anything. You're just seeing what's out there.
So Zhuangzi really thinks that doing nothing is valuable. What is so valuable about it?
I think what's important about doing nothing is, again, this idea of not doing anything intentionally. And that what's valuable about doing nothing is what's unvaluable or potentially destructive about doing something. Because when you do things intentionally and stubbornly, it's easy to make mistakes and to go in wrong directions and to persist in wrong directions.
But you might worry, what about things that need doing? So obviously Zhuangzi is living in a time of great civil strife. And as I understand it, the Confucian tradition says the role of the philosopher, among other things, is to help out and try to, you know, set things straight as much as possible. And Zhuangzi is saying, no, retreat. Couldn't a Confucian say, there's something a little irresponsible about doing nothing. Why not set an intention, a good intention, intention to help out and set things right?
We do a lot of damage in our efforts to help out. A lot of times we're misguided about what we think needs to be done. If something needs to be done, it needs to be done without anybody telling us it needs to be done. So by responding to the situation, by being open-minded, you'll discover that on your own without needing to be taught.
I can tell when I'm trying to do things and when I'm not. Can I tell when I look at other people whether they're doing things sort of in the way that Chuangzi thinks is best or whether they're striving? How do I know?
Do you need to?
Well, maybe if I'm trying to give them advice or encourage them in the right direction. Maybe I shouldn't try to give them advice or encourage them in the right direction. I'm not sure.
Probably depends on the situation.
And we're going to get back to things depending on a situation in a moment, but you're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about Chuangzi with Paul Chelberg from Whittier College.
Is the good life for you the same as the good life for me? Is there anything that's objectively true? How could we even know?
Finding the way to serenity, along with your comments and questions, when Philosophy Talk continues. If you don't feel like doing anything, could that be the best thing you could possibly do? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about Chuangzi with Paul Chelberg from Whittier College.
Got questions about Chuangzi and Taoism? Email us at comments@philosophytalk.org or comment on our website. And while you're there, you can also become a subscriber and find something useful or useless in our library of more than 500 episodes.
So, Paul, earlier Josh and I were arguing about whether anything is really better than anything else. Josh said yes, and I said no, absolutely not. So, Chuangzi would back me up, right?
That's a difficult question. I think different things are good to different people, or at the very least, different things seem good to different people. But there's an underlying question there, a skeptical question about how you know exactly who and what you really are. You quoted the butterfly story earlier. He woke from a nap and wasn't sure whether he was a butterfly dreaming he was a person or a person who dreamt he was a butterfly. I'm not sure that story is really so much about either butterflies or dreams, but about our identities and how sure we are of who and what we are.
So I definitely see that there's this distinction between there being no fact about what is true and it being really hard to know what is true. So it sounds like on at least one interpretation of Chuangzi, he's just saying it's really hard to know what things are like and what your nature is. So is that the interpretation that we should prefer?
Either before or after the fact, it's hard to know. So I think the question of what we really are becomes kind of irrelevant once you confront the fact that you're not really sure of what it is in any case. What difference would it make?
Well, okay, so tell me if I'm wrong about this. I'm trying to think about this question of what difference it would make. Because some of my favorite lines in the Chuangzi are these lines about different beings having different kinds of needs. So Ray quoted one earlier about eels and monkeys and people. And there's another lovely one about ducks and swans, right? Ducks have short necks and swans have long necks. But you don't want to make the swan's neck shorter and you don't want to make the duck's neck longer. Each one has its own kind of way to be and its own kind of needs. And so what's good for a duck is not what's good for a swan. So why not think that's true of individual people? You know, what's good for you, Paul, might be bad for me and vice versa. If that's the case, doesn't it matter that we have a rudimentary sense of who we each are so we can try to do things that, you know, that match what we need individually?
But that's the question, trying to come to that rudimentary conception. There's another story about Lady Li, who was the daughter of a border kingdom referred to as barbarians. And she was traded in a hostage swap with the Duke of Jin. And when she left her life on the border, she was so sad, she was so demoralized that she wept until the tears drenched the collar of her robe. But then when she went to the state of Jin, she was made a concubine and then the queen's consort, and she ate the food of his table and slept in the king's bed and wondered why she never wept. We can change our minds about who we think we are. We can find out that our self-conceptions and identities before were narrow or completely mistaken. And those things will change either internally or as external situations change.
Okay, so I see that in that case, like, it seems like there is a kind of fact of the matter that Lady Li does end up being happy, and that kind of, that's important. It's a fact of the matter that she, in fact, gets to learn even. But I was less sure about whether there are facts of the matter about good and bad, the way Josh seems to think. So there's this kind of conversation in the inner chapter, and it's between two characters, neither of whom is necessarily expressing the point of view of Xuanzi, but one of them sort of is talking about sort of beauty and how different animals have really different ideas about beauty. So men claim that Miao Qiang and Lady Li were beautiful, but if fish saw them, they would dive to the bottom of the stream. And if birds saw them, they would fly away. And if deer saw them, they would break into a rung. If of these four, who knows how to fix the standard of beauty in the world? So my way of reading that has always been, well, just that nobody's right or wrong about beauty. There's just no fact there. So that's not about what somebody would like, but about, like, what really is likable. And I'm not sure that there is any fact, according to the Zhuangzi.
He doesn't say there's no fact. I think the effect of the story is just to get you to cool your jets a little bit. The story about Lady Li you mentioned before with the happy ending, it's not clear at all that story has a happy ending. Lady Li got in good with the king and alienated him against his firstborn son and put her own child on the throne and caused decades of warfare. She's a notorious villain. Probably in her mind it had a happy ending, but not in very many other people. So the question whether it's a happy ending or not, time will tell. Even time won't tell. It will remain a question.
That's a really good point. So we've talked about a couple of really cool features of the Zhuangzi position. So first, what looks potentially like relativism, like different beings having different needs, maybe even different individuals having different needs. We've talked about change across time and the need to be a little flexible and not sort of lock yourself into one mode of conduct or one sort of mechanism for making decisions. But let's think a little bit about the skepticism, a little bit more about the skepticism, because it seems at various points in the Zhuangzi as though a view is being expressed according to which we could be radically deceived about things, right? So that's at least one way of reading the butterfly story. And you know, one of the characters, Chang Wuzi, says, while dreaming, you don't know it's a dream. And perhaps a great awakening would reveal all of this to be a vast dream, right? So there, you know, long before Descartes and other, early modern European philosophers, there's the dream argument. How far do you think Zhuangzi goes in the direction of skepticism, of worries about what it is possible for us to know?
Well, you can take this, you can read these things in a lot of different ways. And I personally, I don't worry a whole lot about dreams or different animals or things like that, but you can change a lot in your life. You can go to bed thinking you're happily married and wake up finding yourself divorced and alone, or thinking you're a great parent and finding out you're a failure, or all kinds of things like that. So there's plenty to be skeptical about without going as far as dreams or things like that. And I think the concern is, given those level of uncertainty and the tendency towards unpredictability and change, you just don't want to get too far out ahead of overhead of your skis and recognize the fact that things can look very different in the morning, and not invest too much in your current conceptions because they're liable to change.
The way that the Zhuangzi is written seems like it supports this idea of not holding on to any one picture of reality too long. Like, there's a lot of, like, funny little stories. A lot of characters express philosophical views. There's a lot of parables. But I'm not sure that I find, like, a single coherent argument in there. Is that accurate? And do you think, if so, that it's doing something?
I agree entirely. I've looked for those lessons carefully for years and never found them. And in fact, I've become kind of convinced usually when you think you've got something, you think you've got some lesson or coherent message, the digger you deep, it kind of dissolves in your hands. And my feeling is the stories, rather than trying to convey a lesson, are themselves kind of an exercise in the unpredictability and the untraceability of human existence.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about the Chinese philosopher Chuangzi with Paul Chelberg from Whittier College. So I shouldn't be reading Chuangzi for a moral message or a view about what the world is like. What should I be doing instead? Like, why should I be reading Chuangzi?
I think the stories are confusing in the way that life is confusing. And that by sort of immersing yourself into confusion, by becoming more confused, you understand better the way in which our experience is confusing, if that makes sense.
It does. I mean, hopefully not too much sense. One of my favorite lines is Chuang Wuzi saying, "If you were to agree with these words, I would name that nothing more than a way of offering condolences for the demise of their strangeness." So here's at least one character who wants his words not to be totally intelligible. And you have other lines in the Chuangzi about, you know, if you got some wisdom, don't say it. So I think it's a fascinating case of a work of philosophy that's, as you're suggesting, doing something other than transmitting propositional content, transmitting beliefs. Here's what you need to know. Here's what you need to think. It's more of an exercise for us. It almost starts to me to sound like it's in the model of the philosophy as an art of living strand of philosophy that Pierre Hadot talked about. Does that seem right to you, that this is, rather than philosophy as a set of beliefs about life, rather it's a set of skills, of habits of mind, ways of coping with a very complicated world, and somehow this book helps us develop those skills. Does that seem about right?
And maybe tolerance for ambiguity.
Right.
One interesting puzzle is, as you read these different parables, unlike, say, a Socratic dialogue, where you know pretty clearly who the hero is, it's often very hard to tell in one of Zhuangzi's story who's the hero and who's the fool. Or if either of them are. And one of the fun things about reading the commentaries, if you want to go that route, is the commentators themselves often pick out different characters as the heroes and the fools in any given story. And again, I find myself asking the same question in life all the time.
That's kind of beautifully balanced. So it's one of the things that I kind of dislike about some of the Socratic dialogues, is that there's somebody who, like, is just an idiot and we're all supposed to think this person is an idiot. And it doesn't help to introduce a moderator. So there's, like, philosophical dialogues with a moderator, and we have the smart person, the fool, and then the moderator, who, as objective moderator, has got a side with the smart person. So why did we bother adding that person in the first place?
Yeah, which raises a question for me about the role of the master thinker, the role of the leader. So someone like Chuangzi, should we say that this is, because of course, you know, within the Confucian tradition, there's nothing wrong with having a role model, with having a teacher. But should we say of Chuangzi that part of the point of writing this book, where you don't always know who the hero is to kind of nudge people away from that mode of thinking?
I wouldn't have said that before, but now that you said it, it sounds perfectly right to me.
Oh, that's, I'm relieved.
Yeah, so I would maybe like to hear more about Chuangzi and rivals or interlocutors. So my understanding of this time period is that you've got the Confucians and you've also got the Moists, who are something like the early Chinese versions of what I think of as, like, utilitarians or consequentialists, where they're thinking, how can we just prevent suffering as much as possible for as many people as possible? Is Chuangzi sort of disagreeing with both of those groups? How do I think about Chuangzi in that context?
Chuangzi's best friend was this guy, Hui Shi, who appears to have been trained as a Moist and was one of many people who left the Moist school later in life, but retained some of their habits. One of the ideas of Moism, Jian Ai, frequently translated as universal love, Hui Zi said, let your love wash over all things. Heaven and earth are one body. Zhuangzi also says heaven and earth, or attributes to characters the phrase heaven and earth are one body. But whereas Hui Zi tries to use kind of Zeno-like paradoxes to undermine distinctions to let you arrive at unity by default, Zhuangzi seems to reject his logical approach. Nonetheless, one of the most compelling things about Zhuangzi, for me at least, I'll see if you feel the same way, is his overwhelming tenderness. He tells stories about all different kinds of people, some very successful ones, some very socially unsuccessful ones, but his sense of compassion is, as Hui Zi said, overwhelming. It washes over all things. I find that very beautiful and inspiring, and I wonder a lot about its connection to these other logical and skeptical arguments we've been discussing.
Oh, that's I totally agree. I love that point. I mean, and you know, as we heard from Holly earlier, there's this astonishingly prescient, ahead of its time way of thinking about disability. There's an enlightened woman in the text. And so, yeah, it does seem like, especially for the time, this sense of compassion, this sense of not just tolerance, but even love, expands about as far as it can possibly go. But here's a question for you, a slightly more, Zhuangzi skeptical question. Why, you know, to come back to the politics, why not try, right? I mean, we did. I know you gave an answer earlier that we sometimes mess up, but surely if we don't try at all, doesn't that mean we're inevitably going to be messing up? Because, yeah, so, you know, one of the characters, Ruo, says, a person of great wisdom doesn't find the cramped and nearby to be in need of improvement, for he knows the temporal changes of things are endless. So basically don't do anything. Are you satisfied with that, Paul, or would you prefer a Zhuangzi who every now and again, you know, picks up a hammer and builds a house for somebody?
Well, I'm not particularly satisfied with anything. it's not clear to me at all that our sum total of efforts to help have outweighed our work harming the world. It's a pretty even bet as far as that goes. But I think the idea is to think of your existence, to address your existence as something that simply is. It's not. He would very much, I think, reject kind of the notion of progress, either material or spiritual or political progress, that we embrace as being liable to mislead us and better off being able to accept existence as a useless tree.
Right. So I'm a little bit tempted to summarize this idea as, well, it's just better to be a useless tree, or at least we have reason to think it's better to be a useless tree. But we've been talking about how at least it's really hard to know whether it's better to be a useless tree. Like, seems like for all I know, trying could be strictly better than not being a useless tree, or maybe there's no fact of the matter, although that's a kind of contestable interpretation. So how can I hold on to both of those ideas at once?
He doesn't actually tell you to be a useless tree. He just shows you all the bad results that come from being a useful tree, and you can decide what to do on your own. Similarly, I don't think it's a question of doing nothing, just sort of recognizing and responding to the harms that can be done by doing the wrong something, and you'll find your own way to your appropriate combination of doing and not doing.
I mean, it's a very attractive position. I mean, assuming it works out, right? I mean, I imagine that for some people it could go awry and that they could think that they were sort of following the flow and going where their inner nature takes them and embracing the useless and not trying too much and doing the right kind of something, which is close to a nothing. But couldn't it fail to work out? Couldn't people be deceived about what's sort of going to conduce to happiness and end up miserable?
Couldn't anything not work out? I mean, the jury's still out on all the options as far as I can tell. But that's a legitimate concern. But like I say, the jury's out on all the alternatives because we're still waiting to see if some of the things that we thought were great bets have turned out to be very unfortunate.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about Zhuangzi with Paul Chelberg from Whittier College.
Could reading Zhuangzi help us take ourselves less seriously? Does his Taoist philosophy offer good ideas for ending war and oppression? Should we all try to be a little more useless?
Doing more by doing less. Plus, commentary from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, when Philosophy Talk continues. Nothing from nothing leaves nothing. Is that a good thing? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Paul Chelberg from Whittier College, and we're thinking about the Taoist philosopher Chuang Tzu.
So, Paul, Chuang Tzu obviously made perfect sense within his own time and place, but he's continued to be an influence ever since. What do you think makes his wisdom so relevant to us today?
Personally, in my own life, I find Chuang Tzu even more helpful going forward than it has been in the past. I think we live in very unpredictable times, and we're going to be called upon to solve problems we haven't seen before, and to think about things, to become things we haven't been before, and to be able to be comfortable with that, and to be able to do that intelligently, responsively, and responsibly, is something that's going to be hard for us in the coming decades, I think. And we're going to need to embrace a philosophy of change because that's going to be our only option.
So I'm particularly interested in Chuang Tzu's ideas about avoiding war, because that seems like an important kind of ongoing challenge for the 21st century. I'm not sure that Chuang Tzu would agree to give anybody advice, but if I could possibly get Chuang Tzu to tell me something helpful about avoiding war, what do you think I should take away?
That's interesting, because a lot of the other philosophers around him talked about war a lot more directly, and that the Confucians had a very carefully defined notion of a just war. The Maoists rejected offensive warfare or aggressive warfare. Chuang Tzu doesn't actually talk about it all that much. But I think, you know, if you think about the problems that oppress us, war is, of course, one of them. But where does war come from? And one of the underlying ones is our sort of underlying greed or need for more. And I think Chuang Tzu is more addressed to that, sort of the underpinnings of war, than to war directly. Widespread poverty and oppression and cruelty in so many forms is indicative of there being something damaging about our general approach to life.
I agree with that, I think. But given that most of the population doesn't agree with me or aren't Taoists, does trying to give up on striving still give me useful advice for the actual world?
That's going to be an ongoing problem for anybody, I think. And you know, how influential has Philosophy Talk been in solving world peace? I know you want to.
Yeah,
I know you hope.
Yeah, we haven't got there yet.
But it hasn't worked that well. However, I think in general, Zhuangzi's approach, like Confucius's, although not necessarily later Confucian's, was really more geared towards leading by example or leading by inspiration, rather than, you know, telling people what to do. I mean, many of our most important figures have led by example, not by inspiration, but how to do that is something we're still working on, as far as I can tell.
That's a really good point. It gets back to the notion of philosophy as an art of living, and also philosophy as something individualized, because if part of your philosophy is, well, you know what, there are actually different good strategies for different people and at different times in their life, well, you can't just write a treatise like Aristotle or something like that. All right, this is a point Alexander Nehemas makes. Instead, what do you got to do? You got to write something like the Chuang Tzu that is difficult and complicated and puts people through their mental paces so that it trains them in certain kinds of capacities and set a really good example. And it seems like Chuang Tzu did both brilliantly. But I still have a question that sort of lingering from the disagreement that Ray and I were having right at the beginning, which has to do with the kind of upshot of this. I definitely see it as being a world, like imagine a world where everyone, or almost everyone, is Taoist. So I think you're going to have less oppression. You're going to have less poverty. You're going to have less war. You're going to have more peace of mind. Where's joy going to be, though? Are we going to have joy? There are a bunch of quotes in the Chuang Tzu that kind of trouble me a little bit, where, you know, for example, the consummate person uses his mind like a mirror, rejecting nothing, welcoming nothing. Can I have my welcoming? Can I have a little bit of joy?
Define joy. I think a lot of what we take as joy is relief from the pain. That our sort of desire for exuberance is expressive of our discomfort with, you know, the other 5 days. But it's a good question. Another thing, I don't think Drawings just sat down to write a book. He wrote some things over the course of his life. There were probably different authors involved, but he probably changed himself a lot over the course of his life. And quite a few of his stories seem to memorialize these sort of turning points for him. So it's hard to know, you know, which stories came first and which came later, or what was the trajectory of his thought, or where he ended up, if that's the right place or anything like that. It's not clear at all that there's a single coherent vision, but more a process of change, or kind of like a piece of music underlying it all.
Yeah, and that's, of course, very much in keeping with the overall philosophy, right? We're different from each other, and we also change over life, and we have to take those changes into account. Is there anything that stays relatively stable, that, you know, some piece of advice that's going to apply to most people at most times of their life? One example that leapt out for me has to do with moderation, right? So there's that story early in the Chuangzi about Zhu Yu, who's offered an emperorship and rejects it, saying, "When the beaver drinks from the river, it takes only enough to fill its belly. Don't drink more than you are thirsty. Don't eat more than you're hungry." Does that seem like a piece of wisdom that applies broadly to, you know, pretty much everybody at any time?
Depends on who you ask. That's another classic example of a story where there's quite a bit of debate about who's the hero of that story. Zhu Yu is talking to the Confucian sage Emperor Yao, who wants to give up his kingdom. He says, "I want to just do nothing." And one reading of the story is that Zhu Yu is responding to him as, "Yao, you're Yao. For you, doing nothing is being Yao. So give up giving up and go back to doing your job." So maybe there's a time and a place for excess, perhaps.
So I want to come back to, like, all of these other participants in the dialogue who I gather were, like, real people that Zhuangzi knew and talked to and was responding to, and some of them might have had a hand in writing this. Do you think that having multiple people in this dialogue helps sort of Zhuangzi or the text of the Zhuangzi, like, have more perspectives and be more open? Is there something better about having a conversation between a bunch of people than just talking to yourself?
That's perfectly likely that he was planning out conversations and said, "I actually taught Zhuangzi to a fifth grade class, and we were describing a story about pulling the fish turning into the bird Peng in the first chapter. And one of the little girls said that she thought he was trying to think through something with it." But I think there might almost be internal dialogues between characters. That said, not all of them are real people. His friend Huizu is a real person, but plenty of the other characters are clearly fictional. Sometimes they have obviously fictional names, sometimes not, like Out of Step Woman or something like that. But then Zhuangzi also, I only recently discovered this, he made up characters. I don't mean made up characters like people, he made up Chinese characters. There are words there that aren't used anywhere else in all of ancient Chinese literature. There's so many of them, I'm convinced he was just making some of them
That's
up.
That's fantastic.
No one
We're
knows
missing
how
so much.
No one knows what they mean. He was just making up noises.
That's fantastic.
Which goes back to his, you know, we think language is different from the twittering of sparrows because words mean something. But if they don't mean anything, what's the difference?
Yeah. What is it that Zhuangzi says? Where can I find a man who has forgotten words so I can have a few words with him? It's such a great little joke. Can I ask you a question about the social arrangements? Because we've been talking quite a bit about individuals finding their way, not to make a pun of it. But what about views? We're assuming that we leave a social arrangement more or less as it is. Is there a better or worse social arrangement as far as Zhuangzi is concerned? And if there's a worse one, is it even possible to be a sort of full-blown Taoist and sort of make things work out?
There were a few groups kind of radically questioning the social order at the time, but not very many and not very much. Zhuangzi's response more was to flee it, to reject it. There's some stories about him being asked to serve in government and refusing to. I think, you know, the time he lived in was called the Warring States, and it was getting worse and worse and worse. And I think it seems plausible, not certain, but possible, that both Lao Tzu and Zhuangzi kind of figured people are going to tear themselves apart. And it doesn't look like we're going to be able to stop them. So we can just choose not to do that. So that it might be not a question of either saving the world or not, but just, you know, escaping with your life from a world that's not going to pull itself out of this nosedive.
Right. But there do seem to be some moments at which a world is envisaged, almost a kind of Rousseauist back to nature kind of picture. You know, tear everything down, destroy treasure, get rid of musical instruments, no carpentry, and let's live really simply. But maybe that's just one voice in the Chuang-Tzu.
Yeah, there are a lot of different voices, and some of them are almost surely different authors, but it's easy to overblow that because Chuang-Tzu himself surely went through many different phases and doubtless had many different moods. I don't think he would have been shy about indulging them.
Paul, it has been far from useless, this conversation. I don't mean that as an insult. I mean that as a compliment. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Our guest has been Paul Chelberg, professor of philosophy at Whittier College and editor of Skepticism, Relativism, and Ethics in the Chuang-Tzu. So, Ray, what are you thinking now?
Well, I'm thinking that birds gotta fly and fish gotta swim, and I gotta enjoy making philosophy talk because it's in my nature.
Yeah, even if we don't get the Nobel Peace Prize for having ended all wars. We'll put links to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and dive into our library of more than 500 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on the blog.
Now, a man so fast he makes everyone else look useless, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, the Zhuangzi is like a really deep joke book, chock full of little anecdotes designed to deny everything you know, which people enjoy as long as they don't really have to deny everything they know. It's like college kids, back when I was a college kid, blaming things on karma, which we thought meant tragic flaw, but was really just a thing that happens. Karma could apply to the fall of Ozymandias, whoever he was, or going steady, passing a midterm, running out of gas. Zhuangzi is a real person, but it's also the umbrella name for all those who contributed to the output over many, many years. Kind of like the writers who put out Nancy Drew, who were less like ghostwriters and more like employees making product for the syndicate, or, if you will, followers of the Tao of Drew. The little tome called The Zhuangzi of his / their writings arose in a time of warlords and dynasty collapses, which may account for some of the willfully blasé worldview. The Zhuangzi gives a lot of attention to useless things. Huge trees, for example, that are no good for lumber or food. Civilization wants to burn them down or chop them to flinders so we can put on a rice paddy or a pavilion, condos, something you can use. No, no, says Zhuangzi, lie down under or upon the giant tree. Take a nap. Leave the useless tree alone. Quit chopping things down for a darn minute. Still, Zhuangzi is accepting of the world as it is, ambitions, greed, and all, and even is willing to contribute to it if we follow the Tao. Our best moments, he claims, are intuitive and come after we know what we're doing. We learn to ride a bike, and after that, we don't think about it. Habit leads to second nature, which is part of nature, and nature is the way. It's all pretty basic, yet a bit magical. Thomas Nagel wrote an essay, What Is It Like to Be a Bat?, often used to inspire classroom discussions about consciousness, concluding that we might know what it's like to hang upside down, or fly at night, or even echolocate with the proper training. But we can't really know what a bat's experience is like. That's why we have AI. Duh. But now we return to Zhuangzi, who lived over 2,000 years ago, and his most famous story about dreaming he was a butterfly, and then waking up to be Zhuangzi, and then wondering if he was dreaming he was a butterfly, or a butterfly dreaming he's Zhuangzi. Heavy. The butterfly or me paradox echoes quantum physics, in which subatomic thingies can be both wave and particle until you look at them. It all seems kind of creepy and inexplicable, or in the case of understanding bats, frustrating. Don't sweat it, says Zhuangzi. This is all just a moment and the flow. So just as learning to play the guitar enables you to annoy people at parties without looking at your fingers, so too does writing and thinking make it easier to make our way in this ever-shifting world. Markers, signs, bridges to the other side. Now here's another story. Zhuangzi and Wei Zhu, his Taoist friend, were strolling along the dam of the Hao River when Zhuangzi said, See how the minnows come out and dart around where they please? That's what fish really enjoy. Wei Zhu said, You're not a fish. How do you know what fish enjoy? Zhuangzi said, You're not me. How do you know I don't know what fish enjoy? Wei Zhu said, I'm not you, so I don't know what you'd know, but I know you're not a fish. That proves you don't know what fish enjoy. Zhuangzi said, Let's get back to your original question. You asked me how I know what fish enjoys, so you already knew that I knew it when you asked the question. I know it by standing here beside the river. Now, sure, that's speciesist and exhibits alarming amounts of subjectivism and privilege, but maybe those weren't minnows, but koi fish he's talking about, which are always relaxed and swimming around, not like barracuda or walleye or warlords. Or minnows, snapping at bait and racing to the bottom. Koi enjoy life. Therefore, a view from a bridge is always correct, like having a dream as you nap under a tree. Also, to add more layers, Zhuangzi is not only the author and ghostwriter, he's also the hero of this fish story, and the butterfly story, or the butterfly of the story, depending on where you came in. This, too, is the way of Tao. If you're wandering, All thoughts are true. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2023.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Jamie Lee, Elizabeth Zhu, Emily Huang, Merle Kessler, and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
It's done, man. Towel of love.
What?
That's what I call it. The towel of love. You being with Molly defies, like, forces of nature. It's over, man.